What's up, everybody? Welcome to Moon Traveling.
Well, hello.
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 And welcome back to another episode of the Moon Traveling Podcast.
Welcome.
What's going on with everybody?
I've been doing good. It's been a bit hectic, but it sort of always is. And right now, it's sunny on Vashon Island, which is pretty remarkable. Nice. And beautiful. And got a lot of different projects I'm working on, and they're all really fun, and I feel grateful. So that's what's going on with me.
Awesome. Anything notable?
Not yet.
Cool. NDA. Got it.
Yes.
What about you, Jeremy? What's going on with you this month?
I am in the lovely city of Atlanta, and I am enjoying this work trip that I have to do. So I'm doing good.
Nice.
But yeah, I mean, I'm grateful to be here for real.
Nice. Yeah, I'm mixing an EP, and then the label is putting out a micro EP with Kick Snare Crash in May.
Nice.
We're doing a music video that comes out for Pacifico at the end of May. And then your album, Aaron, comes out in July.
Yeah. Stoked.
That's it, I think, when it comes to news.
Nice.
So we're going to run into this episode, I guess. Who do we have?
Today, we are going to share with everyone our conversation with Mike Herrera, who is, among other things, the lead singer of the band MXPX. And it was really fun. So here it is.
Cool. So our guest today is Mike Herrera. Mike Herrera is a husband, father, and American singer, songwriter, and musician, best known as the lead vocalist, bassist, and songwriter for the punk rock band Magnify Plaid, better known as MXPX. He is also the frontman for the bands Tumbledown, The Cooties, and Arthur, as well as the bassist for Goldfinger. He owns and runs Monkey Trench Studios and has a podcast called the Mike Herrera Podcast. Originally from Bremerton, he now resides in Waco, Texas. Without further ado, here is Mike Herrera.
Woo-hoo. Nice. All right. You got, is that the Wikipedia version?
I always like look up a couple different things and then kind of compile it together kind of thing. Did I miss anything or is there anything incorrect?
I mean, I live in Bremerton, Washington.
Oh, okay. So you don't. Okay. So everybody go to Bremerton now.
It's kind of complicated because, you know, it's hard to nail somebody down when, because I'm always somewhere else, but
sure, yeah.
We have a place in Waco, so technically, yeah, I guess I live in Waco too, but
for tax purposes, you live.
Yeah, I wonder. It's funny because I don't even think I personally own our house in Waco because I wasn't there to sign the papers. So if my wife wanted to get crazy.
Yeah.
That's funny. That,
I went and signed the papers for our place, but you know, it's like, she probably could have just done it. Cause I was just like, whatever, just tell me what to do. You know?
Yep. Yep. Anyway, too much information.
Cool.
Never.
Well, it's great to meet you. I know you two have already known each other for years, but it's finally nice to meet you.
Absolutely. Myself. How you doing, man?
I'm doing well. Yeah. Thank you for one of your episodes of your podcast. You featured your Music Monday. You featured my band, and I appreciate that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Great song. Great song. So you're in Atlanta? Is that?
I am. Yeah.
Atlanta. Wow. Okay. We're going to be in Atlanta. MXPX is playing.
I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. You should come out.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's March 15th coming up. I don't know if this podcast is going to be out by then or not, but.
We'll try to get it out before then.
There you go. But yeah, what's going on in Atlanta? I know you probably have some questions for me, but is there any bands that you go that come through there that are from there? Like even something like, you know, like poor old Lou or MXPX to the Pacific Northwest. But is there anybody out there like that?
I mean, if you're talking about like who's come from the Atlanta area, that's awesome. I mean, Athens is just a stone throw. Oh yeah, I mean,
is there anybody still there?
Still there. That's a good question.
Is there anybody there now?
Manchester Orchestra might be the biggest band that's still going from here. Microwave, they're doing pretty well. They're from here. Yeah, but I mean, the good thing about being in a city like this, we do get lots of great shows. Like you're coming, and I just saw Two Door Cinema Club a couple days ago, and they were great. There is a really good independent, music scene here, and I'm actually working on trying to make a collective that is uniting musicians to, you know, let people know, you know, that they exist and such. But yeah, just like anywhere, there's good music. I think that, as you know, getting people to hear and being aware of what you're doing and what's going on is, I think, harder than it used to be. It's a yelling match, I believe.
Oh, it is for sure.
But we are here to talk with you, and nobody gives a shit about me.
That's right.
So tell me. Yeah, I mean, like, I know you people might already know your story. I don't know if you want to start from scratch or if you guys want to talk about how you two know each other. But let's start from the beginning. Tell us how you got into music and how you got started with MXPX and how you two met and all that kind of jazz.
Well, you know, we don't need to go through the whole thing, but I think starting early, 1992, it was the summer before our senior year of high school. No, for our actual first year of high school. So for us, that was 10th grade. So we're going into 10th grade, and that's when the band started. But we just started doing shows. We're pretty motivated from the start, and fast forward probably another year, maybe 1 year, or things happen so quickly back then, you're young. So it's like hard to gauge how long things took. Like now it'd be like 2 years later.
No, but it was I think about that all the time. You go back and you start doing a timeline, and what you think was like 2 years apart was like 3 months apart. It's like crazy.
Exactly. So I don't know exactly how long it was, but we did our, you know, local shows. And then boom, there's this place called New Song Coffee House in Port Orchard, Washington, which is about 15, 20 minutes from Bremerton. And poor old Lou was playing. And we I'm pretty sure we did not get on the show. We went to the show. Mm-hmm. We went to the show. We were fans. You know, we weren't fans previously, but we were like, we checked them out and became fans. And had a demo tape, gave it to Aaron. I don't even know what, you know, it's just what you do.
Sure,
okay.
Yeah.
If you have a tape, give it to a band that's playing, you know, that's headlining. So we went to the show and it was awesome. You guys played great, sounded great. We gave you the tape, we met, talked. So that, I'm pretty sure that's the first time I remember meeting Aaron. Although, you know, Aaron wasn't who he is now, you know, and I'm not who I was then, but it quickly, like, I think the next time, what that led to was, honestly, the next time you guys came, we played with you.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly.
Yeah, I can actually fill in a few details here.
Yeah, please, because
And my memory is shit, but I do remember a few things. I remember getting the tape, which I still have, the Orange Station Wagon tape, from, I think Andy and Yuri gave it to me. And I this could be wrong, but I remember them giving it to me at a show that Poor Lou played in Olalla.
Oh,
and you weren't at the show. They were there and you weren't there.
Okay.
And I could be wrong about that. And in fact, I should probably ask some of the other guys in Portal Lou, because they have way better memory than I do. But I do I do remember it was like a church and they had this big field and they would have bands play outside in the field. Like they had a stage or something. That's all I remember.
Wow.
Yeah. But I do remember New Song. What happened was Poor Lou was playing. We were actually opening for a band that was, I don't even remember who they are, but in that moment they were bigger. and they broke down and didn't make the show. And you guys were there, and I had met you because I had met Andy and I think Yuri. I definitely remember meeting Andy at the other show. And you guys came up to me, you know, everybody was talking about how the headliner wasn't going to play. You guys came up to me and you said, like, we can have our gear here in like 30 minutes if we can play. And I went up to the promoter and was like, hey, do you mind if these guys play since the headliner's not going to be here? And he was all kind of pissy and he was like, sure, whatever, I don't care. You know, and so then you guys played, and then I was totally blown away. I was just like, holy shit, oh my God. And I think Bill was at that show too. I believe Bill Power was at that show, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. That's kind of, you know, it's so funny. It's so hard to remember those details.
Oh, I know.
But that sounds like something we would do.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, that was why we became successful.
You were hungry.
Convinced.
Yeah, you were just like,
oh, let's go, let's go.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So funny. Wow. Yeah, you guys, yeah, whatever the circumstances was, it was a lot of just that magic of the moment. Mm-hmm. And just you guys were out there playing shows all over the place. Like, who plays shows in Olala?
I know.
Right? Like, it's crazy.
I know.
For those listening, Olala is basically like an exit off the freeway between Port Orchard and Gig Harbor, Washington,
yeah,
which is like near Tacoma.
Yeah.
So it's just,
I saw it on a map the other day and I was dying. I was like, oh God. But, and then I was just talking to my wife about how all we are is our memories and our memories are all wrong. Right. And, yes. And like, it's such a trip, but, I remember offering to do the demos that night to you guys. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I at least had the thought of doing them that night. Because I had just started working in the studio at the church at Calvary Fellowship in Wallingford. I had just gotten the keys to that, you know, and kind of had some free reign in there. So I was like, let's do some demos. And I don't remember if I said this that night or if I said it later, but I do remember saying, you know, I'll do them for free. I just want to be able to give them to my friend that just started this label before you do anything with them. You don't have to pay me anything. You can do whatever you want with them, but just let me give them to this guy before anything else happens. And you were like, yeah, whatever. Let's record. Let's do this.
Let's go. Yeah, yeah, I was like, let's all about it. Yeah, absolutely. I remember that, given how history seems to happen very quickly, you know, the early years, it probably was that same night. Because we were all probably, you were just like, let's go.
Yeah.
And we were like,
let's go. Yeah.
All right, whatever. Yeah, send it to him. Cool.
I don't really have any memories of recording those demos, though. Do you?
I have a little bit.
Yeah.
Not a whole lot of detail, but like I remember the room, you know, it was in a gymnasium and then the room was connected to that or something. I don't know if it was a gymnasium. There was a big room,
yes,
and then there was the small room, mm-hmm, and it almost was like a recording or like a radio station almost would look,
yes,
like.
Yes, yep.
But it was a recording studio.
Yeah.
I mean, all the recording stuff was there. And I just remember kind of what it looked like,
mm-hmm,
and I remember we did it very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I remember doing the vocals. Everything was one take, and we were blown away. We're like, oh my gosh, it sounds so good.
They're
just wild.
They actually hilariously hold up. I mean, they're on what? Let It Happen. I think they're on Let It Happen. And
I think there are some, yeah.
Yeah, a couple of them are at least or something, but they're awesome. I think they're great. And they are really that just capturing a moment. I was super green. I had just really been teaching myself how to do multi-track recording. I was for sure when we did those demos, I was 19 years old when we did those demos. So I know that. I was, you know, green. You guys were just like, let's go. I was like, let's go. And there's something beautiful about that moment. And I, you know, I don't know that the record was much different than that, to be honest, because we didn't have very much time or money or whatever to do it. We were just kind of plowing through the record. And I was out of my element, but, you know, I was out of my depth. I was figuring stuff out as I went when we were doing the record. But
Did you use any of the songs from the demo on the album, or y'all just started fresh when you came to the album?
There was one or two songs that made and we left two off. But I wonder how long it was, because I remember when you sent it to Brandon Ebel, and at the time they were in Orange County, mm-hmm. Tooth & Nail was in very new.
Yeah.
They had three, maybe one or two releases. Third one was about to drop, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it was like Starflyer and...
Wish for Eden was the first one, then Starflyer.
Yeah. Wish for Eden, Starflyer, and maybe one other. I mean, they were
focused.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah,
that sounds right.
So I don't remember, but I assume it was pretty quickly, because when we did the demos, that first recording, it was four songs.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It was four songs.
And it was going to be for a 7-inch. Mm-hmm. And Brandon was like, I want to do a 7-inch. And then when he heard the songs, he's like, let's just do a full album. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just like, screw it, let's do a full album. And that must have happened pretty quickly. Had you worked with many other bands before you did Poking At You in that bit?
So I had done some, you know, very indie stuff, Friends and stuff in the church studio. And then I did the first Blenderhead record, I think like 2 months before we went in and did Poking At You. John and Stu's with Phil Eck, actually was the assistant engineer guy on that, which is crazy because I'm such a giant fan of his. And he taught me a bunch of shit that day too, that I still engineering stuff that I still use, or that week or whatever we were in there. But yeah, so I was still... I was spinning. I was like, I had no idea what was going on. I mean, I was excited and I felt good about what we were doing. But Avast is the studio that we recorded Poking At You in. I had been in there. Poor old Lou had done. We had done some tracking in there for our records. And Stuart Hollerman, the owner, he was kind of one of my mentors early on. I used to rent gear from him, and he was really supportive and really encouraging. And so I picked that studio, and it's the original Avast that's not there anymore in Wallingford. I have a couple funny memories of the record, but it's kind of all a blur too, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There was a lot of fun moments, like the Cheesy as Can Be song.
Yeah.
I mean, just kids. We were all just kids, honestly. Like, we were still in high school. It was the summer before our senior year we recorded that first record. And so that record came out the fall of our senior year, which would be 1994, I guess.
Yeah.
And then
it came out.
Graduated in 95, We recorded the next record spring break of 95.
Crazy.
So it was even faster than the first record. But I just remember recording Poking At You. We didn't know anything.
Yeah.
And we didn't know that you didn't know anything. So, but it was just like, okay, let's put these songs onto tape.
Yeah.
Like, we didn't know any techniques. It was just like, you sing it, it's done. Is it on there?
Yeah.
Cool. All right. I didn't even know about overdubbing or
Some of what I was doing I had done, you know, for maybe a year. And some of what I was doing I had just seen other people do for my band. Because, you know, I'd done one record, I think, by then with a producer, I believe. Mind Size had been done. Anyway, so yeah, we were, but you know, I was nervous because I essentially lied to Brandon. He's like, do you know how to do all that? And I was like, yeah, oh yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah. And and just knowing that I'd figure it out. And the two funny memories I have were to me, they're funny now. Maybe hopefully they're not offensive. I remember when it was mixing. There's two memories from mixing because I swear to God, we recorded that whole record in like 5 days and then mixed it in like one day or something. I mean, it was crazy how fast we did it. But I remember the day before we started mix, I asked you, and this is something I had seen other people do. I asked you guys to bring in some references for mixing so that I could know kind of what sound you were going for. And I remember you brought in an Op Ivy 7-inch.
Love that.
Oh my God.
Was there a record player there?
Yeah, there was. We listened to it. Okay. And I put it on and I looked at you and I said, "This is how you want it to sound?" I was all confused. And you were like, "Yeah." And I was like, "Okay."
Yep. And that's so funny.
And then I do remember, you know, I don't remember how many songs are on that record, but it's a lot. And I remember I unironically asked you multiple times during mixing, "Didn't we already mix this song?"
Yeah, probably, right? Oh man. Yeah, we definitely could have cut some things down on that.
Oh, it was,
and it's so,
it was, it's so perfect funny to me. I love it. I think it is so, I just listened to it again the other day for the first time in year. I mean, 10 years probably. And, it's so adorable kind of in a way. And like, but it's so important. It was so important to me. I was so proud of it. And, I felt like I was around, I got to be around the origin story, you know, of this greatness. I knew that you were great. For the second I saw you play that show, I was like, this guy is born to be a star, kind of a thing. And I just was excited to be a part of it. And it was truly an honor. And like, and then getting to do Secret Weapon, you know, all those years later was so fun. And that's still, that is in my top 10 favorite records I've ever worked on. Secret Weapon is like it.
Yeah, that was,
it is. I think fun. It is, to me, it's a perfect, like, I don't know what you would call it, pop punk or post pop. I don't know what people call music record. It's perfect. I think it's so good. Like, it's just, I actually listen to that somewhat regularly. It's one of the very few records that I can listen to that I produced.
That's right. Yeah, Secret Weapon is still, it's a staple, you know, in our shows. And
that's cool.
We always do it.
Yeah, and we can get to the story of how that came about later. But yeah, I just wanted to tell you, I don't know that I have been able to, that I just wanted to thank you for letting me be a part of that beginning of all that. Because it was a big, dude, big deal to me.
I mean, I appreciate it. I think it kind of happened because we met, honestly. Like, how was Brandon going to find us if not for you? Or, you know, so it's pretty wild. And then through you, we got to go start playing shows at some of the house party shows in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And that was early on for us. We were like the little kids, like little kids playing skate punk. It was like, wow. Mm-hmm. It was almost like a novelty because nobody played that fast. And nobody was as young and little as we were. So
yeah, it was awesome. And like, and then like, I just saw some photos of a show in the gym at the church in Wallingford. It was a bigger show that we threw that you guys played. I think it was like Poor Old Lou, Soul Food, and MXPX or something like that. And this was early on. You know, this is
that was a big, big,
yeah, there was like
1,500
people at that show or something like that. It was crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun.
That was cool. I have no idea how people found out about things back then.
I don't either. I have no concept of like how to. And what's really funny is now that's a huge show now too. 1,500 people is still a massive show. Like I remember like it. There was a time where people would be like, oh, you know, about numbers like that. But now people would be like dying to get 500 people at their show, you know. So it's so, and that was, you know, no internet, no nothing, right? It's so weird to think about all that.
Yeah, flyers.
Yeah, like literally flyers.
Posters. Yeah.
Which I don't know, but I've seen that because of the oversaturation of the internet that people are responding better to physical things again. You know, it's that circle kind of thing.
Cuts through the noise.
They went from digital music to now they're doing vinyl, and I think it's working the other way around with marketing and stuff. It was like, you know, Facebook ads and events, and now people don't want that, or, you know, don't even care about that. They want, you know, you give them posters out or you know, handbills, and they're like, oh, cool. Okay. Yeah. I'll check the, it's so strange.
Yeah. I mean, all things come and go, you know, bell bottoms are going to be back in. Right?
Yeah.
JNCOs, right?
Yeah. JNCOs.
Skinny jeans are out.
I still wear them, but yeah.
They'll come back. Yeah.
I mean, you guys most
so does too. He's going real tight.
You guys most definitely were part of a perfect storm. You know, like it was one of those things where, you know, it was such a pivotal point in your lives to meet each other, and we had talked Aaron and I on the podcast about how he got involved with Tooth and Nail and stuff as well, and it just all was really just a perfect storm. And I don't know that it could have happened any way than it did. You know?
Yeah, it's a trip.
Yeah, it'd be something else. It'd be the, you know, the other timeline.
Yeah.
Wow.
In the MCU. Yeah.
I think I remember, I can't remember if it was an article I read, this is years ago, or maybe one of those VHSs that MXPX put back in the day, but I remember reading or hearing something, Mike, where you had said that when you guys did your first tour that you didn't expect anyone to show up, and then you would show up to the shows, and not only were people there, but they knew all your songs, and you were just flabbergasted.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the numbers weren't always 1,500, yeah. Like, you know, that's
so much. Yeah, it's just
but, true. We were, that first tour was with Blenderhead and us, and it was, we were trying to do a tour the year before, and it fell through. And because of that, actually, a little personal side story, I had asked for the time off work. I worked at this place called Spiro's.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about
and
that.
And I asked for time off work, and they gave it to me. And then I ended up not needing the time off, but it was too late. They were like, they were looking for a reason to get rid of me because there was money going missing on the nights that I was working. And so instead of just asking me or, like, you know, whatever, they just left me off the schedule.
Oh my God.
So I just got a new job at a new place. But it's funny, I'm friends with the manager now, and I'm pretty sure he doesn't think I ripped him off, but the manager, the owner, the actual owner. Yeah. Anyway.
Did multiple of you guys work there?
Yeah, I got Yuri a job there.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And his first day, he spilled a bunch of dishes on the owner. Just like, what? And crashed. They, like, broke everywhere. He's like, I'm fired. I'm fired first day. Like, I'm out of here.
That's funny.
Yeah. Oh, I am crying right now. That is so good.
So
is that the only job you had other than doing music?
No. I had landscaping jobs, construction jobs. Construction was more like I was the first guy. So I would do the construction cleanup. I would do the grab all the wood from the truck and bring it over to the pile and, like, things. That's what I would do. I got into a little bit of hammering here and there, like, if it was easy, but I was young. I mean, this was late junior high, early high school. So, but then I got into the food service, Spiro's. After I got done with Spiro's, because they wouldn't put me back on the schedule, I went to this place called CBEC Conference Ground, which is a place that, like, companies go and have conventions or meetings like retreats. Retreats are big. You know, you drink your coffee and you know, de-stress. I don't know what it is, but I would be the guy that would wash all their dishes, set all the tables. I would go and, like, deliver coffee. It was a thing. It was kind of the closest I came to, like, working as a camp counselor.
Yeah.
You know, because it kind of had that vibe where you're, like, kind of in charge, but you're not really in charge at all. Like, yeah, you're just a kid. So, but I got a truck to, like, drive the coffee around the grounds. And
crazy. That's awesome.
So that was my senior year of high school. And in between all that, I was also doing MXPX. And,
yeah.
And, you know, we started flying out spring of 95. Our first show out of state, aside from driving to BC, driving to Portland,
right.
of course.
Right, yeah,
but
yeah.
That, to me, was like, if you can drive, it's kind of local. But we flew to Orange County and played played some like church basement, you know, mm-hmm. And it was packed, like over 1,000 people.
Sick.
And so that was pretty wild. So going into the tour, we weren't certainly expecting that for you know, every show, but the first show was with the Crucified.
Oh, nice.
So it was pretty big. Yeah. And that was also where the crowd footage of our punk rock show video was filmed.
Oh, cool.
It was at that show. And it was, you know, Crucified, Blunderhead, MXPX. Pretty good, Bill.
We had talked about this with Ronnie Martin, but like, it's so strange, and honestly, I miss it, how diverse shows used to be. You'd play with bands that were so much different from the music you play.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of miss that, because that variety really, I think, lended to people, for bands standing out. You know, nowadays they want the tours to have comparable bands. And so I feel like it's a lot harder to stand out.
That's interesting.
What do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of have to have your own sound where, you know, even though there's other bands that sound like certain bands, usually like somebody like Korn, that nobody sounds like mm-hmm. Korn. Like,
right. True.
Korn is Korn. So I think, honestly, as a band, as an artist, that's what I'm always aiming for, is just sound like me.
Yeah.
Continue to sound like me. And, you know, obviously, like, people will find you, but yep. you still have to like get yourself out there mm-hmm. for people to find you.
Sure. Tension spans are very small.
I don't know. I mean, I think that's true in some ways. You're probably right. Like, we used to do, you know, we did that Offspring tour, and it was the Offspring, Cypress Hill, and us. And so that was
that's
a little
awesome.
Bit of a diverse, a diverse cool. bill. And then Blink tried to do that with Lil Wayne.
Yeah.
Lil Wayne.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it was because of the bill that tour failed. I think it was just a weird dip in the algorithm something
sure,
where
there's
they missed their opportunity on the launch of that, you know, tour, mm-hmm. you know, the ticket sales launch or whatever. That kind of happens sometimes, but on a major scale like that, you don't usually see it. But I'm sure if they did it now, the tour would sell out instantly.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So now that they're back on their upswing.
I have a question. Early on, I guess till now, but when you guys were popping off, you knew, okay, this is what we're going to do. Where do you feel like you're, as a band, like you're the place you can always come back to and always sell out a show, like your hometown, your community? Is that, where is that? Is that Seattle? Is it? Is that a thing? Do you have that? Do you feel like you have a big following in the Pacific Northwest or in California, or like what do you think about that?
I've found that there's definitely cities that we do better in.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it has to do with population, but not always.
Yeah, for sure.
And is it an election year?
Yeah.
but yes, Southern California, just the style of music matters too. So like for us, Southern California, anywhere there we can sell out. We just sold out the Hollywood Palladium, you know, which
that's
is
awesome.
Huge, you know, and so that's like 4,000 people. And so if you go around the world and go, okay, where are other places that punk rock is big? I would say Tokyo, Japan, anywhere in Japan, but Tokyo, Japan, Jakarta, anywhere in Indonesia. It's very big there. Sao Paulo, Brazil, or anywhere in the big cities mm-hmm. of Brazil. It's going to be huge. Mexico City, huge population. They love punk rock.
That is so cool.
We're going to be back there. We'll be back there. Sum 41, MXPX, and the Ataris with nice. a couple other Mexican bands in March, end of March. So still going strong on that. And then as far, you know, more US stuff, yes, Seattle is always sort of a hometown show. And then every now and again, we'll play a Bremerton show, which is literally our hometown.
Yeah.
But we try to do at least one Seattle show a year, usually in December.
Yeah, I missed the Showbox show. That sucked. But
yeah, catch this year, yeah. This coming year.
Yeah. I mean, Aaron's just belittling you. I mean, you where do you not have a good crowd?
No,
right?
I didn't mean to sound ignorant in that sense. I just that
I'm just
that
kidding.
Hometown feel, you know, where you're like, this is our people or whatever. I was curious.
I mean, San Antonio, Texas. I'm not from there at all, but I'm Mexican, so they love me there. And it feels like home. Yeah. It does. And same with Dallas, Texas, and Chicago. And, like, there's so many, like, key cities. Orlando's always amazing. But, yeah, the hometown feel, of course, Seattle. We always feel like, because it's our families there. And then anywhere down in L.A., some of my other, like, extended family will come out. So that kind of feels hometown-y,
too. That's so cool.
Yeah.
I love that. Sick. What do you...
Well, yeah, I mean, like, so I typically, it seems like, would you say that life in general is when your career kind of took the next bump up? Was then, or was it before that? Was it after that? Where do you feel like the next, like, bump up in your career really was?
I mean, we were touring full time by the time we recorded Life in General.
Mm-hmm.
We did Poconetcha, started touring after we graduated high school, that is, in 95. And then recorded Teenage Politics so quickly we did it so quickly after Poconetcha that it was like these two albums were a really great momentum mm-hmm. into our touring life. We had enough songs to play, like tons of songs to play off the two records, two things to sell. And then that really just, we had such momentum going into Life in General. We almost couldn't lose, you know? I mean, I feel like we'd made a good record, but like, I feel like we made a good record because we were touring so much. We became a different band.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you play, we had never played as much as we had played in our lives. So like when we did Poconetcha, we weren't touring. We were just these kids in the garage be like, okay, how well did you practice, you know, after school today? You know, like that's a bit. So that's what that was. And then fast forward a couple of years and we were able to make Life in General. And I'll credit Steve Kravac because he kicked our butts. He really made us do it again and again. But by that time, we all knew that was kind of like, I mean, we didn't even know that was how you make a record by then, I guess. We were probably still in our ignorance. But I'm sure by then, Aaron knew that, okay, let's make him do it over again. But so by the time we got to Secret Weapon, you know, things were so much easier because he had made 1,000 records and we had made a couple records. So it got easy. But yeah, going into Life in General, we got our butts kicked. It was do it again, do it again, do it again. I lost my voice. I sang so much. And I was doing Chick Magnet the very last day. I stayed 2 extra days and the guys drove the van back home to Bremerton. We were recording at West Beach in Hollywood. And I just got a flight for like 2 days from now. We'll be done. We have to be done because the studio's booked.
Yeah.
Chick Magnet was the song, the last song that I recorded on vocal. Yeah. And I was doing those and then Steve drove me to the Burbank airport and I made my flight.
A dwee da awesome. And doo da. I remember you guys doing that all the time when we did Poconetcha. You do like little scats. A dwee da and doo da.
I mean, for kids like me that really paid attention to like the Tooth and Nail label and all that whole scene and such, it was so cool that they started playing that on MTV. And like, we were like, oh crap, a band we actually like is getting some notoriety. Like, this is awesome.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it is cool. So I have to ask you, Aaron, do you remember on Poconetcha you say, Mike and
No, what?
You don't?
Was that on the record or is that something you said in the studio?
It's on the record. It's on the record. There's like, it's like, it's at the beginning of either, I don't know what song it is, honestly. It doesn't even matter. It's on one of the songs. But everybody's like, what does he say there? And they don't know that it's you because it's not credited, of course. But it's you, because I'm like, I remember that. And I think you were saying like just my name in a weird, funny way.
I was either referring to you or the microphone, one of the two things.
Or it's possible. Or miking the mic.
Yeah, I was miking the mic. That is funny.
Did you ever write songs differently? Like, I know a lot of artists, they start and they're just writing songs because that's what they do. But then as you start making it a career, you're writing songs for a record or thinking about it differently. Like, okay, this is going to cohesively all go together. Is it ever come like that? Or was it always just, I'm writing a song because this is what I do? And
There's been seasons of, I don't know what I think and I have no thoughts.
Sure.
And yeah. I struggle with like ideas like that. And in those times, I feel like those are the times where I'm thinking too much about the outside world and about what people are going to think about this or that. Whereas if I just let all that go and just, if you just get bored enough, usually you come up with something good. It's a product of overthinking, I think. So yes and no. I mean, yeah, I've definitely changed how I write over the years mechanically. But I always go back to the basics. Basics mm-hmm. for me would be writing on an acoustic guitar with a notepad. Nowadays, it might be like a voice memo mm-hmm. recorder mm-hmm. on my phone. And then a notepad. But also, I'm not like coherently writing on the notepad like I used to. It's more like a line or two. And then I always have it on my notes mm-hmm. pad on my phone. So yeah, in that way, it's definitely changed. But I always have pretty much recorded my ideas. It started out on cassettes. I had a boombox record. And then it's morphed to like on tour, I had this little micro cassette tape recorder. Mm-hmm. Took that all over the world, all over Australia. I've written so many songs on records and just started there. So. Love that. But honestly, the worst thing for an artist is getting too in your head about whether or not you're doing it right. And I feel like the best way I've been able to do it authentically as a songwriter is write the song, even if it's bad, even if it's not necessarily good for this album. If you have it in your head, just write it. And if you come to a place where you're like, okay, I wrote a first verse and a chorus, or I just wrote a first verse, I write that until I don't have an idea. And then I can set it aside and come back to it later when I need a song like that. Mm-hmm. So I kind of do it like that. Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah.
And yeah, so I just kind of allow myself to go with things. And if a song's too good, even if it has, this isn't an MXPX song, but it's like, no, this is really good. I just go with it. I just keep writing it.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's good.
What, I guess on that train of thought, like, I guess, do you, when you're writing a song, do you know, okay, this will work for MXPX, this will work for Tumble Down, this is an Arthur song, or like, when you're doing those projects, you're like, specifically writing for those projects, or like, do you set them aside for each thing, or?
Usually after I write the song, I try to make everything MXPX first, and then if it's just not working. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, back in the day, I mean, Arthur's not a thing anymore, but right. Back in the day, it was like, okay, slow song, Arthur. Or 50s, real. But even some of those Arthur songs, I mean, you could speed them up. You could figure out a way to do it if we wanted to. But, and then when it came to like Tumble Down that I did, around 2007 to 2013, that was, I wasn't writing as much of MXPX. I needed a break from punk rock mm-hmm. at that time. And sure, I feel like that was my way of like getting away from it for a little bit so that I could come back to it and be better at it. And I feel like I did that with those projects. And besides that, with Mike Herrera stuff, like, and now and again, I'll release something just on, you know, my name mm-hmm. or whatever.
Yeah.
But I haven't ever done an album. It's always been singles, or a live album. Of course, you know, I've done some live stuff. And I just actually released a song with my daughter, Linoleum by NoFX, and re-released that under my name just because doing that under MXPX just didn't make sense, even though we'd probably be even bigger if we did. But no, it's just there's certain things business-wise, too, that we like
right,
to separate.
Right, right, right. That makes sense.
Aside from the sound. Yeah. But yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. We had a lot of people write in about that cover. Everybody's loving that.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
I want to know your perspective of how Secret Weapon came to happen with me.
Yeah, that's pretty much where I was going next to.
With you specifically?
Yeah, like just the story.
Nothing to do with Tooth and Nail?
No, all that. Yeah, so, Tooth and Nail, everything. What happened? How did that come about?
Yeah, because you moved from Tooth and Nail to a major and then came back, correct?
For one record, right.
We were on A&M for three albums, two albums really, if you count. I don't really count. Well, no, Buffalo, I guess, was a major label. So Slowly Going the Way of the Buffalo, The Ever Passing Moment, and Before Everything and After. There's three albums we were on a major. And we, after Before Everything and After happened, we just didn't have confidence in our team at the record label because they just did not understand punk rock at all. And we just kind of wanted to get off that label. That's it. So in retrospect, we should have taken the money, but our principals, unfortunately, have lost us a lot of money over the years. and it's not always worth it, but at that time, that was like 2003 and 2004, 2005, somewhere in there, we signed to Side One Dummy. Mm-hmm. So Side One Dummy Records, and put out Panic, and that came out in 2005, I think,
yep,
somewhere in there. And then we put out a B-sides album with them, just something to, you know, put out a product. And they wanted us to do, you know, our next record with them. And there was no issues with them, but at the time we were being managed by Tommy Rat, who his management company was called Interim Management, meaning I'm not going to be here for very long. So he was, Tommy Rat, for those that don't know, he was our tour manager, our sound guy. He was the guy that would like book shows for us in those years. And then so he's like, well, everybody's calling me already anyway. They're emailing me. So I'm going to help you guys. I'm going to do some deals. And so that Tommy Rat is how Tooth and Nail came about, how we started talking with Brandon and everybody about doing a deal to do Secret Weapon with Tooth and Nail, what we could get back for it, what they would get for it, obviously. Save face kind of thing. Like, it's kind of a big political, like, olive branch in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I remember feeling that way about it. I was shocked when Brandon brought it up to me. I was like, what?
Yeah. I know. So crazy. And Tommy Rat was just, like, on the phone with me, like, just oiling me up and just like, man, okay, we're going to get your publishing back, you know, this, that. And honestly, like, life could be way different now if we didn't do that deal. I don't know, maybe in a better way. I don't know, but like, I don't regret doing that deal. And I don't regret doing the deal to sign to Tooth and Nail in the first place, where we had no leverage and no royalties.
And no idea,
you know,
what you were doing.
And no idea. Yeah. But you know, either way, we got to where we are now, and we've put a ton of miles, you know, under us, and life is good. So it's like, okay, well, I guess you can turn some bad things into good, and doesn't make it right or whatever, but I get that there's different opinions, varying ideas of what really happened. So, you know, so I was just like, all right, you know, like maybe it's time to just put it in the past, you know? And so that was just our thought, was like, if everybody was on board, let's do it. Let's do a deal. And, you know, we were on Warped Tour that year. We did Secret Weapon. We had that come. Maybe that was, I don't remember the timeline, actually, because we weren't on Warped Tour when... We weren't on the whole thing, I don't think. Maybe that's what it was. Because I remember somebody sending me a picture of a secret weapon banner that was being floated across the sky at Warped Tour. But so anyway, going back a little bit, though, when we do the deal, and I remember part of the deal was we got to use the studio. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure we got to use your studio for free. I know we paid you a fee or whatever, but it was like part of the deal or something. And but we went to London Bridge for the drums, which sounded pretty
great.
Yeah,
that was me. I wanted to do them there.
I'm glad we did.
Yeah, me too. That's pretty much my all-time drum room. So and, you know, friends with those guys over there for so long. Like, since I was a teenager, I've known Jonathan Plum. And I have a funny story about the drums, too, because we did all the drums in 2 days, I believe. It might have been one, but it was a short period of time. Obviously, Yuri doesn't need a lot of time. But we wrapped pretty late. It was like 1 a.m. or something is when we got done. Because we cut... can't remember if we cut to tape on that record. I was doing drums to tape a lot back then. If I was there, I would cut 3 takes at 30 ips. I'd cut 3 takes to the 2-inch, and then we'd listen back to those 3 takes while we bounced them into Pro Tools, so I could just get some tape on the drums. Anyway, I remember it was late. I in my head, I want to say it was 2 a.m. And I was beat. I was dead. And we had to go to the studio the next day to start overdubs. And you're like, I want to do the bass. And I was like, cool. Yeah, we'll do the bass tomorrow, bro. And you're like, no, I want to do it right now. And I was like, I remember just going, I forget who was engineer, like the, you know, the in-house engineer guy. I was like, do you want to track Mike's bass right now? And he was like, sure. And you cut all the bass for the whole record that night before we left.
Wow.
Yeah.
I remember that. I was falling asleep on the couch while you were doing it. I was just like, I was checked out. And I knew we were going to reamp the bass anyway. So just get a good DI and we will. And you just, I remember you put your leg up on like the transport controller for the 2-inch machine or something, and you just sat there and just rocked through. And I was already such a fan and like so impressed with you way before that, and I watched you do that and I was just like, god damn, this guy is just a machine. Like, because it was all perfect. I didn't have to touch shit on any of it. It was just great. And you, like, almost as long as the record is if you played it, is how long it took you to track the bass on it. I mean, it was crazy. It was awesome. I've retold that story many times in my life because it was a great story. But that record was just so fun, so easy. It was the first time I'd really spent any concentrated time with Tom too, and he and I really clicked and had so much fun with guitar tones, and it was just easy. It just felt like, you know, your songs are good, everybody's good. We all were on the same page. No one was fighting about anything. You know, no one's trying to get their idea heard the loudest. It was very synergistic, you know, cohesive, just easy. And it's a great record. So, yeah.
Dude, thank you. Yeah, that was fun. Just doing the vocals was a breeze. The mic sounded great. The studio sounded cool. And then going to Cha-Cha, of course, always, up on Capitol Hill. For those that are not keeping up, we recorded the drums at London Bridge just 2 days, which is north, like Shoreline, North Seattle area. But then the rest of it was in Capitol Hill at the compound?
Yeah, that was my place.
The latest version of the compound, I believe. That place was cool, man. Like... it didn't need much. It just, you know, a couple rooms and really just two. I think there's two different rooms, but It was easy. It was like you said, it was really easy. We kind of had that studio routine that is, if you know it, it's kind of like a comfort mm-hmm. in a way where like you come in, you grab the menu, you order mm-hmm. some food, you know, you might not do that the first thing. Like maybe you come in and you start working, but just those things, like it's just part of the fabric of my life. Like those little routines and show, you know, tours and shows have their own sort of routine kind of like that too. Like, okay, what do you want for after show food? And, you know, just little life things that you kind of have to deal with because we're all humans and we got to keep the meat sack running. Yep. But it was good.
That's awesome.
Always love finding like new places and new favorites.
Yeah.
Did you ever work out at Robert Lang for anything?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
The Dale's Deli over there was a huge favorite of ours. Dale's Deli in
Yeah,
Shoreline.
That sounds so familiar. What did I do? Rose Blossom Punch mixed our record there. I did Gramma Train there, I believe, is where we tracked a bunch of that. Something else. A few things over the years I did there. I was friends with Bob a little bit, and a couple of my friends worked there over the years as engineers, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't remember if Kip did or not, Kip Bielman, but everybody did. So, and I know you guys had some. Was it Tom that had the crazy ghost story at Robert Lang too with his strings, with his guitar strings? Was that Tom or you or?
I think
because that's a supposedly haunted studio, and
yeah, there's a couple things that happened to us.
Yeah.
The one that I can remember really clearly was we were recording late all together as a band. I set my bass on the stand and we left. We came back the next morning. My bass was halfway across the room and face down the other way.
Oh.
So like somebody had picked it up and set it down, and it was like, and it wasn't damaged. Yeah. It wasn't mess. It was.
That's
so that
weird.
Happened.
Got a ghost rock.
I think the strings being to Tom. I don't remember the specifics on that.
It was like he did a take, came in, listened to it, went back out, and all the strings were completely detuned on his guitar in that short period of time. Yeah, that's what I heard. Right. And I believe Tom told me that story actually. But, that for people that don't know, that studio is crazy. It's like the whole studio is underground. Like it's like a bunker. And there's all this lore about how it got built. And there was huge amounts of it that were unfinished at the time. Like this massive, almost orchestra pit size room that was like unfinished and creepy. It definitely, you lost complete track of time in there too. Like you just had no sense. There was no windows. You're underground. No sense of time. It had a vibe for sure. Killer place though. A bunch of like legendary records have been done there too. So, that's funny.
We recorded Buffalo there, and that's exactly what happened. Yeah. Like we ended up Steve Kravac did that record, and we ended up not sleeping until like four in the morning mm-hmm. most nights. Some nights Tom would be walking back with Steve, and the ferry. Like it's morning time and the ferries were going. It's just like you just go and go and go, and that we always called that the big cavernous room that was unfinished, the orchestra pit. We called that the Indiana Jones room.
Yes, totally.
It looked like okay, but that place is creepy. So Dubby is the name of Bob's buddy. He used to be his drug dealer back in the 70s or something. And Dubby got in with the wrong crowd or something. You know, of course, wrong crowd. But ended up stashing all this money. This is the lore, the legend. And stashing all this money where the toilet is upstairs by the lounge. There's a toilet area. So, like, Bob said he had a dream where Dubby's ghost was pointing at that spot. And this is before anything's built. And he goes, wakes up the next day, starts digging, and sure enough, finds I don't know what he said, $400,000 or something like that in cash. And that's how
he used that money to build the studio.
whether or not that's true, he just had some sort of trip. That is a
it
great
is true,
story.
As far as I'm concerned, I don't want to know if it's not. It's the best. Yeah,
exactly.
And welcome back to Ghost Investors.
Yes.
Yeah, this was before all the ghost TV shows that you know came out later. Like this, we were just scared shitless because we didn't know what to think of what was going on. Like, I wouldn't. There were certain nights where the vibe was so creepy where we would not go up to the top lounge by ourselves. Mm-hmm. Mm. Like somebody, hey, you want to go? I gotta go take a pee. Can you come up with me? Like.
Crazy. That's awesome.
I remember those Vashon Island stories.
That's so sick.
Well, Mike, when you record, do you guys typically stay to your instruments? I mean, that you just do bass, or do you ever do guitar as well? Are you the only vocalist? Do the other guys sing as well?
Mostly I do bass. Every now and then I'll do something on guitar, just, you know, for whatever reason. But mostly not. And then I'll sing my parts vocally, and then Tom will sing his parts, and Chris will sing his parts. So if it's a gang thing, mm-hmm. we all go in there and do it. We get some girls and some mm-hmm. children and other people.
Yeah, I think we had a gang vocal day on Secret Weapon and had a bunch of – you guys had friends come in and stuff like that, if I'm not mistaken. I'm pretty sure we did that.
Yeah, like 20 people came in. It was great.
Yeah, that's cool. That's fun. And now you – tell me a little bit. Last thing that I wanted to know is just tell me a little bit about your studio, how that came about, progressed, the kind of I still haven't been out there. Now that I'm back, I definitely want to come check it out and stuff. But yeah, just tell me about that.
Yeah, so we had a studio for a while over where our merch, you know, the MXPX merch arsenal is, where we do all our mail order out mm-hmm. of now. That used to be our clubhouse studio. And then I finally got this place in 2007, built it into a studio. Mm-hmm. It's a house. But Monkey Trench Studios started making records for mm-hmm. other people. And then over the last really 10 years, it's just been MXPX all the time. You know, just whatever my projects are here, my podcast out of here. We do live streaming. We recorded, you know, the last two records are self-titled in 2018. And Find a Way Home, that's out now, our new album.
So cool.
That's all recorded here.
Love it.
And yeah, we just, you know, we love having a home mm-hmm. base. We love having a place to just think up crazy ideas and try to like build them, tinker on them. And so it's like, it's all things. It's like not only a place to like actually record, but it's a place to sort of experiment, mm-hmm. do some R&D, a little research and
right,
development.
Flesh everything out. It just is it's an obvious natural evolution, right? It feels such a need, and it's so intuitive that you would have that space for yourself. Yeah. You know, you don't have to think about that element that was such a huge obstacle in the past. Historically, you know, getting the budget to get into the studio, booking the time, da 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 da, all that stuff. Now that's kind of removed from the equation, so you just get to freely create and do what it is you do. And I think it is just so cool and so important, 100%. You know, that you have that. And you know, all the guys I know that make records, that are producers or engineers or whatever, including me, started out their experiences because they were on the other side of the glass, right? And you know, that understanding of being on the other side of the glass is what makes a good producer. So it makes somebody be able to make a good record, whether it's for themselves or other people. And so to me, it's just a natural progression from being the band to being the producer. And I love it. I think it's so cool.
Yeah, I wish I would have done it sooner.
Yeah.
You know, we were thinking we could have taken some of that major label money and put it into a nice studio. But like, we kind of when we took our cue from the All Guys, from the Descendants guys,
right?
Because they built the Blasting Room in Fort Collins, mm-hmm. and after they were talking about that, you know, and just how they took all their record label money and put mm-hmm. it into that, I was like, I'm so dumb. What am I big? Like, and so, I, you know, I pulled some money together. We did our own thing, but you know, it's just sometimes it's like this, like with stocks, you know, a lot of times you think I'm too late,
yeah,
I'm too late or whatever. But if you get in now, you're not too late for like 10 years from now when you're like, man, I should have got in 10 years ago. So I think of that as like, okay, when I got into the recording situation, it was a little later than I should have probably, but it's given me the experience over these years to know what's important, to know, hopefully to know what to spend money on and what not to.
Well, that's the key, you know, right? Like it's that. It lets you filter out all the stuff that is truly important from the stuff that, because people talk a lot about, you know, this mic, this amp, this preamp, this the compressor, this thing, all these things, right? That really are in the end noise. You know, if you have a good song and you can get it to sound how you hear it in your head, it doesn't matter how you did that. It doesn't matter what you used to do that. What matters is that you have a system, you have the gear that you can do that with, right? And so you figure out a lot of all that superfluous kind of nonsense about recording and producing and all that when you do it yourself. And when you're doing it for a purpose, you know, you're making these records, you're making MXPX records, right? You're not just like recording your friend that no one, you know, see, you have, that's the best school you could ever go to right there, you know, doing that over the years. And that's why there's,
and the latest,
that's why
the
latest they're so good.
Sound incredible.
It's incredible. Yeah. That's why it's so good. Cause you figured it all out. And of course you did. You know, that's how I look at it. Like, yeah.
Thanks. Got to give some credit to Ryan Furlott. He came in and pushed record and mixed it too. So
nice.
But yeah, I mean, that's the thing is like to have a place that we can do this. And, you know, if it's something we just want to like record today, I can go in there and push record and we go. If it's something we want to plan out and have a collaboration, bring somebody in. It's beautiful. Yeah. You know, now and again, you know, we have friends come in and do their projects in here. But we, you know, it's for me when I do that, it's more about, okay, is it a friend? Can we do this? Is it going to screw up what we're doing with MXPX? And as long as it's not going to do that, then I'm more than happy to have people come in and check it
out. Yeah. So over my career, I still love gear. I still get excited about it, but I've found the most value is shortening the distance between the inception and the execution is the most important thing. Just giving yourself that ability to just almost instantly start fleshing something out. Because in that environment, for me anyways, I end up using half the shit from the quote unquote demo on the record. You know, you're like, why would I redo that? It's great. And you know, you start chasing this feel from your demo and you're never going to even find it again either. So you just use it. So when you sort of remove this demo and real recording sort of thing, then you're just always really recording no matter what you're doing. I think that's really, really cool. So
that lends to a question I had about the latest two albums. Do you guys record the songs as they're finished, as kind of like what Aaron's talking about? Or do you get together the group of songs and then, okay, for the next week or two or next month, whatever, we're going to record these songs and make an album?
Rephrase that?
Yeah.
Are you booking time like you would if you were booking it in another studio and making your record in this kind of time frame, or are you sort of just piecing it together over time?
Oh. Yeah. No. I've got 10 songs, let me put them out. Or I've got 10 songs, let's book out time and let's record them to make an album.
We book time. We book time with everybody. So just because of schedules.
Sure.
And, you know, especially if we have somebody come in. But even if it was just me engineering, I would be like, okay, let's do a session. Can you do today for, you know, couple hours in the afternoon or something like that. You know, that's what we'd do. But once we're making a record, we're recording every day until it's done. And, you know, Tom will come in at certain times. Yuri will come in and get his thing done. And then we won't see him for a while. And maybe he'll come in towards the end. But that's pretty much it. We like to run it as much like a regular recording session as as we can, because it keeps us on point and get things get done. You know, they finally get done. But I have to the other way. I've done it that way in the past. I think I think Plans Within Plans, which is really the first MXPX full length that we did here. And I actually I did that one myself. So like, and then Stefan mixed it. Stefan Edgerton, Descendants. But that one was a little more free flow. Like I was doing a lot of the parts myself. Tom would come in, we'd do his parts, and it'd be like, okay, I'll fix that for next time when we're done. And you know, like it was more like that. Like I was managing the project myself a little bit more. And then, but the last couple records, we just ran them just like records. It's
cool.
I really feel good about it. I feel good about the memories we made, because when you have the band, you know, like somebody like Tom Wisniewski coming out and saying like, man, let's do that again. You know, like I want to do it just like that. Like, let's really, like that's when you know, okay, we did it right. Like this is the way we should continue to do the records. And whether or not we record exactly the same way, like the actual music or whatever.
Sure.
It's more about the momentum you get when you schedule it and just keep it going.
I think that the other way is a little more chaotic. It can really become a monster. The record can become a monster when you're just kind of piecing it together here and there. And
Because it's never done, right? Yeah. It can never be done.
It's like demo-itis.
Yeah. But and then in the traditional way that you're doing it, you retain that sense of urgency that all of our favorite records had to them, because they had this certain time frame they had to make it in. And then that cohesiveness too, and your brain, you can hyper focus for that period of time and get it done. I just did my first record in a long time, you know, that was booked in a studio. This band from New Jersey called the Warhawks, and it was magical, you know, just doing it like that again, you know, and how, you know, you're capturing that moment. You know, and it's hard to keep that vibe when you're piecing something together. And I think there's really 100%. Great records that have been pieced together that I know that I'm a fan of, that I know were and I've made. But it's just a different way of doing things. It's very different. It has a completely – it's a different posture that you're taking towards the whole thing. And I think what you said, Mike, is key, is like, when is it done? You know, like, and that's you know, any artist's kind of nightmare is to get into that mode of when it's done. So, or when is it done?
Yeah, and different artists have different sounds too. So, like with MXPX, we have a traditionally real sound,
exactly.
And so, when you're trying to be real, it's more obvious when it's fake. But if you take somebody like Acceptance, everything's very digital and very like kind of just like, oh, that sounds awesome and. It's more of a modern sound
vibe.
So it could it could sound perfect. You could have some pulsing synth thing going on, and it's like, that's not out of place. But if you heard that on an MXPX record, you'd be like, there needs to be a context for it. There doesn't need to be on an Acceptance record.
Yeah.
I feel like
that's what you're saying.
You're expecting it. So we kind of keep that in mind when we make our records. It's like, okay, how far outside the box are we going? Sure, we've gone further and further with guitar effects on the last couple records than we had in the past. Just at, you know, this riff has a different effect than most of the other songs or whatever. But you know, we still haven't gone like synth, and we haven't gone, you know, we haven't gone crazy with vocal delays and vocal effects and stuff like that. We kind of keep it fairly real.
You haven't gone Kid A on and us, if it is what you're saying.
Yeah, not yet. Yeah, yeah.
Next album.
And so it's kind of fun to do that kind of stuff, but I almost feel like that would be like a side project or something, you know? Like, yeah, yeah.
Cool, man. Well, I know Matthew has some listener questions, and I don't want to take up too much more of your time, so let's get to those. Sure.
I also wanted to say real quick that, like, I admire your just what you do. You guys are independent now, and you do everything yourself. You have the merch arsenal. During the pandemic, you guys just killed it with the online shows, and you're always touring and just, like, it's inspiring.
Absolutely. And I think you guys are the bar when it comes to all that stuff. Seriously.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. Wow. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So yeah, we always ask our listeners and we got a crap ton of questions. So one, I'm not going to ask you every one of the questions. Second of all, if there's something I ask you don't want to answer it, just let us know. We will not put it in the show. We will skip it.
Sure.
But, I think the most common question actually was about your appearance on Fixer Upper on HGTV.
Yes.
Jesse Norrell, Mr. Matt, and Caleb Jackson all asked about that. I'm going to say everything. Basically, they said, any Fixer Upper stories? Have you seen the DIY movie? Apparently, you're in that. I think they took footage from the show and put it in that. And then I think Jesse said, I really enjoyed your appearance on Fixer Upper. There were a couple of times I thought I saw you almost cussing at your wife elbowing you. Was I imagining that? Any behind the scenes on that experience? I felt like you were playfully poking the bear.
Yeah. So Fixer Upper, I'm pretty sure I get the story wrong because my wife recently said, hey, I don't think it happened like that. But I always say that, like, she was watching, you know, we used to watch Fixer Upper now and again, and she would watch it more than me, but I was like, mm-hmm. Oh, this is a good show. It's interesting. And so I knew about the show, and then I came home from the studio one day, and she was like, I signed us up for Fixer Upper, so if we get on the show, we got to get a house in Texas. And I'm like, all right, no problem. Well, we didn't get on the show from that because that's like signing up proper on the website. We were down in Houston for the holidays, seeing some family during Christmas that same year. And she basically sent me a picture and said, all right, tweet this to Chip Gaines. And so I sent him a picture on Twitter of, you know, the kids holding its sign that said Texas or bust. And I said, you know, we're ready to move these, you know, these cuties to Texas or something like that. Pick us or whatever. Yeah, I said something like that. The tweet is public. You could literally go to my Twitter and find it from like 2017 or something. Maybe it's 2016. Anyway, that starts this sort of like jumble of people starting to get a hold of us. Cause I'm like, he wrote us back. He said he wrote us back and says, how could I say no to these, you know, beautiful people? I don't think he said that exactly, but we started getting calls and basically they put us on the show. Somebody had dropped off the show and they were looking for somebody. And instead of going to the thousands and thousands of applicants, they just looked
at Twitter.
That's
awesome.
Apparently.
Yeah.
So we, you know, all these years later, we still have our house in Waco. And that's why people think I live in Waco, because sometimes I'm there. I do go there and hang out.
That's awesome.
But as far as the show goes, I remember that moment. I remember that moment seeing the episode where Holly's like giving me a rib. I think we just couldn't believe that this was real, that like Chip and Joe made us a house and now we're getting to see it. And so like, I don't think I was about to cuss or anything. I think I was just like, I was grabbing her and she was grabbing me and like she's, you know, elbowing me. It was one of those. It was like a really sincere like moment of shock.
That's awesome.
But they edit, you know, they tell you when you're on the show, they say, just talk, do whatever you want. They'll get the editors will make you look like you said something good, you know, or whatever, right? And I'm just like, what does that mean? Yeah. Okay. But honestly, I didn't want to make the show about me. So I let my wife be sort of the point person. It was she made the decisions on what we wanted. She chose the colors and the, you know, all the stuff, the style. I like it. You know, it's not like whatever. I get to choose plenty in my life. I have a whole house here that I decorate that it's like a man cave studio, but that's what I should have called it, Man Cave Studios.
So pretty much your advice is just you got to be a go-getter because that's how you get things done. That's how you met Aaron. That's how you got on Fixer Upper. You got to go for it.
I think so. Even, you know, people are shy, you know, socially a lot and awkward. And I'm not any different, honestly. I think I just, it's almost like you jump in the water even though you know it's going to be cold. Yeah. That's what I do. Psych myself up, go talk to somebody, call somebody, text somebody. Like I'm constantly calling and texting band people that I don't know. I mean, I don't mean constantly like every day, but probably at least once a week I'll text somebody I don't know. It's wild.
I mean, that's how you
get... Aaron, you're like, no, thank
I did
you.
It for the first time really in my life last year. My stepdaughters are huge, huge Pierce the Veil fans. And they were coming to Nashville. And I was like, surely I know someone who knows how to get me on the guest list for this show. But I've never done anything like this in my whole life. So I texted Randy Nichols. Do you know Randy? He manages Under Oath and like... Yeah. Yeah. I text him. He's like, yeah, here's their manager's email. So I sent an email. It was so hard for me to do this. I wrote this email out explaining who I was. You know, my name's Aaron Sprinkle. I'm a music producer, you know, blah, blah, blah. And anyway, long story short, she is a huge Acceptance fan. They're like one of her favorite bands, their manager. And so she's freaking out. And then the band is huge fans. The band knows who I am. I had no idea, absolutely no idea. So, you know, my daughters are, at the time, were like 22, 23. And we get on the guest list. We get, you know, backstage passes. We get to go back and meet the band, get their pictures taken with the band. I mean, and they are, these girls are losing their, they think that I am the coolest person in the entire world. So it was awesome. But it really was a huge step for me to send that email. Like, I've never done anything like that. But then that's I was wild. Like, what have I been missing? The worst thing that someone could do is not respond. That's literally the worst thing. Or say, like, I don't know who you are. Leave me alone or whatever. And, like, I did it again. I texted Maddie Mullins and was like, hey, do you know anybody in Noctiluce? Because they were coming here and... they're like Abby's favorite band right now. And we got on the Noctiluce guest list for that show. I mean, it was awesome. So we just like, I'm like, I'm going to just keep that rolling.
Yeah. Keep it rolling. I mean, that's kind of how Vic got into here. Like although I have known Vic for a little while, but Vic actually wrote a bunch of the songs off their new record here at the studio.
Crazy.
When I was like, that's right. Be out of town in Texas.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is crazy.
So he just came out and he just needed a place to chill.
That is awesome. I love them.
Very cool. Great band.
They are so good live too. Oh my God. They're incredible live.
We have a question from Nathan McBroom and Mr. Matt. They asked, has anyone ever covered one of your songs and you loved it?
Yeah, absolutely. There's been a couple that I was like borderline, like they might be doing this better than us. I can't really think of who they are now. There was somebody that did responsibility. Well, Anne Berlin did Responsibility on their last tour a couple years ago.
That's cool. Their original final tour.
Yeah. The first final tour. And I thought that was pretty dope. That was cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Good work, fellas. Yeah, I don't know.
Matt.
They blend in.
It would have been sweet if you would have said no to that question. No.
No.
Well,
no.
Are there any bands that...
No, I love it when people cover. Come on.
Tell us who the worst is. Matthew Matusik says, how do you compare the state of punk or pop punk now compared to when MXPS first came up? Are there any bands that you now see as an inspiration from the younger generation with what they're doing? I guess they're asking, is there any younger bands that you think are inspiring you?
Inspiring me? I don't know about any young bands inspiring me, but like, no, I'm kidding. But
there's a couple.
Yeah.
No.
I was just thinking like a good band that's kind of cool is Spanish Love Songs, but they're not inspiring. They're sad, depressing. Every song is like the worst day of your life. You're just like, I'm going to kill myself. But there's something compelling about it. So I kind of like that.
Love that.
You know, it's funny because a lot of the bands that I've been listening to lately are not new. They're like, but they're putting out new music. Yeah. I mean, Smoking Popes, always a fan. The Ataris just put out a live record today as we're recording this.
Nice.
I know none of them are new, but it is inspiring to see bands continuing to, you know, be creative. And man, it's hard out there to continually be creative. You have to like come up with something new, come up with a new way to say it, you know, a new way to like present your video, whatever it is, right? Like sometimes it's just taking a step back and doing it better than you did, you know? So that's what I, there's a hardcore band called Drain. It's pretty cool. I don't know a ton of their stuff, but I've seen their clips a lot, and they look like they're having a fun time being a band, you know, and that's what I love to see. On the songwriting tip, Mercy Music writes great music, and they're a newer band, still going. Brendan Schulz has been on my podcast. He's a singer. Those guys are just really, really good at what they do as far as like playing their instruments, shredding, writing really intricate parts, and it's fun. I like that. Let's see who else. Pup.
Oh, Pup's great.
That's a new band that's doing well, doing it their own way.
Yeah,
being kids. You know, I know they're not kids anymore, but I'm sure that they feel like kids. Like, because I'm thinking back to like when we started and became adults. We never realized we were adults. So we were just, because you just keep going, you know, there's no transition from high school to college, college to career. Like there's none of that.
You didn't put the suit on and go to the 9 to 5. It just, you know, it never happened.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that you're advocating for people to listen to new albums by older bands, because I think the most offensive thing that I ever hear out of someone's mouth is, oh, they're still making music.
Yeah.
I can't stand that, because it's like, that's what they are. They're a musician. What do you think they were going to do? You know, like
what's great. Yeah. What's crazy is when you hear fans talking about the new songs and you're like, yeah, of course there's fans that actually come to the band in that new album era. So it's hard for the older, you know, group of fans to believe that or to like understand that, but it is a real thing that, there's plenty of people that come and find the new
album.
Your
newest record is some people's first MXPX record. That's crazy. Yeah.
Exactly. And as long as us as an artist kind of go into it knowing that and thinking that, I think we can make everybody, well, you can't make everybody happy, but you can at least have a better perspective of what people want, you know, because online you gotta be careful of listening to the loudest contingency. It might not actually be the most popular thing, whether it's, you know, play this song, don't play this song, come to this city or whatever. It might be like three people. You don't know. So doing the research is with important.
Politics, anything. The loudest voice online is very rarely the majority opinion. Like very, very rarely from my experience. Yep.
In your opinion.
In my opinion, which is the majority opinion.
All, which is also online.
And also correct.
Yeah. I mean, I think that as an artist, the best thing we can do is really trust our own gut and believe in ourselves. And I think that I remember early on, I watched like behind this, was it Behind the Music, whatever, on VH1, about like Kiss, and those guys were not getting signed, and they were like, what are we doing wrong? You know? And you know, obviously the first album that went off was a live album for them and such, but like they said in the interview that they were like, we just knew that if the four of us believed in what we're doing, there has to be other people that also believe in what we're doing, you know? And mm-hmm. I think that for me was very inspiring, because like, it's true. I mean, what you're doing on paper, like if you did do an album where you did a Kid A kind of thing and did something crazy, like as long as your heart and you believe in it, then that's all that matters, you know? And there'll be other people that see that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's what you guys are doing.
Yeah, you'll find your audience. Yeah.
I got a couple more for you. Joe Spicer says, I know a lot of people really enjoy the style of the song Ready to Rage. Have you guys ever considered putting out an all aggressive skate punk album? I think a lot of punk community would really love that.
Yeah, we've thought about it. I think it just doesn't ever happen because of reality. But we could. I mean, more likely we might do a couple more songs like that, you know, that kind of thing. Like anything, if you have too much of a good thing, it becomes not as mm-hmm. good.
Yeah.
So I think why people like that song is because there's not 1,000 of those. You know, there's A Secret Weapon, there's Ready to Rage, there's a few songs that are like, and they're all really strong, I feel like.
Yeah, so, yeah, and there's this thing, I think, where if you go into something, you know, those songs I imagine happened just sort of naturally, right? You didn't go, let's do, and then you get into the world of making really contrived sounding stuff. You know, if you okay, we need one more song like that, we got to write it.
Exactly.
I think that can hurt the integrity of it a little bit, I think, but I don't know. That's just my opinion.
Yeah,
I agree. Because then you're like, okay, well, we need a song idea lyrically to reflect the aggressiveness mm-hmm. of this mm-hmm. song, and so then you're just thinking of something just because it needs to fit in the song, rather than feeling something and going, oh, I'm writing this song right now. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, as an artist, that's, you know, you guys know, you've been doing this a long time, but that comes and goes because we've been doing this for so long. There are times where you just can't get away from having this, okay, I got this idea. I mm-hmm. won't let go of this. I mean, this is a good idea. I have to finish this song. I got to write this song.
Yeah.
And sometimes you do force a lyric in there or whatever. But honestly, I feel like there's a few songs where I'm like on the edge of like, okay, I might have should have rewritten that lyric better or something like that. But for the most part, when it makes a record, I'm like, okay, it's fine. Or it's good, you know, I stand by it is what I mean. I don't mean like good enough. But so after a while, when I hear a demo, I'll know if I want to like fix the lyrics. And there's definitely like, there was like a song I wrote that didn't make this latest record that I just wasn't, the lyric was like almost there. And I was just like, it feels like I'm forcing it.
Yeah.
Like we were kind of saying. And so I just kind of like, let's keep that hold that back and let these other ideas continue forward because they feel more right to me.
Yeah,
100%.
That's cool.
Well, we had a ton of questions, but we're not going to get to them. And I'm sorry for everyone listening if we did not get your question. But question I'll ask is from Jacob Hedke. He says, "What would your dream job be if it wasn't music?"
Ooh, that's a good question because there's so many things you could do in life, so many avenues. And I'm trying to think of what would be cool. Like, is it something I'm interested in, or is it something that I think I would get interested in because it's such a cool thing? So like race car driving. No, I think I'd get tired of that after a while. It's a lot harder than it looks. Like I've gone to the mini, you know, go-kart racing and it's fun, but I don't know if I'd want that to be a job. So, so things like an astronaut, that's like you're asking for a real hard time, right?
Yeah.
So I gotta like think about it. Like I love watching documentaries about mountain climbing. Mm-hmm. I don't think I want to be a mountain climber.
So it's a list of the things you don't want to do. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. This is a list of things I do, but things I love to watch, yeah, but don't want to do. Equally an important list, not the same list you asked yeah for. I think all of the things I think I would want to do, I eventually would not want to do. Like, I'd like to own a bar someday, but then I'm like, I don't want to own a bar. That means I'm going to have to stay up till like 4 a.m. every night. You know, so,
you would have to hire somebody to run it that you trusted, which is also really tough.
Yeah. I would be a Nepo baby if I could do any job.
That sounds awesome.
That does sound pretty great.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
It sounds easy.
Yeah. Honestly, like, if we're being realistic, to be realistic, what would I do? I would probably do content, do filmmaking, anybody that would give me a job doing something, with a video camera. I would say I'm decent at filming. I'm okay at editing. I can get the nuts and bolts done editing. I'm not like higher echelon at all. So I'm like a grunt worker in the content nice industry.
That's your dream
That's
job.
What I'd be. That's not what I would want. That's my dream job. It's my realistic dream
I
job.
I love it.
But
my realistic dream job is working at Guitar Center.
Can I just Netflix? Have you seen those videos where you can make thousands of dollars being a Netflix screener? Like, you just watch movies.
It's like, yes, please.
Well, don't you think I'd be doing that if that was a thing?
I would play those apps that you get real money for playing. That's what I would do.
I legit had a friend that was a roommate, and he did not have a job, and his job was playing poker online. I'm not even joking. And he made great money doing it.
Oh, yeah. I've known some professional blackjack players in my day. Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely one thing, you know. But
it sounds awful.
But I've never met one real person that has been like, yeah, I do affiliate marketing and I make $30,000
a
month.
Right, yeah.
You know, or whatever. Yeah. Like, a week. Yeah. Some people say a week.
Totally.
I don't know.
I would like to become a Nigerian prince.
Yeah.
My God. So good.
Well, thank you so much for giving us your time.
Mike.
I really appreciate it. Is there anything you want to promote? Obviously, you got a new album that came out. You're playing shows. Plug whatever you want, man. You got a podcast?
Yeah. I put out a podcast every week on Monday. But the main thing is MXPX, the new album, Find a Way Home. We have different vinyl variants and merch and all that at mxpx.com. But I'd love for you guys to at least check out a song from the album. Go push play and see if you like it and see what we're up to. And if you like that, you can also check out our latest, our album before that from 2018. It's self-titled. Those are the last two records we've done. If you haven't already heard Let's Ride, that's kind of the popular track off that last album. And then this album, Stay Up All Night. We made a video for every song on the record.
Love it.
And just had fun with that. And we're coming to some of your towns. I mean, we're coming to Atlanta March 15th and then Orlando March 16th, MXPX and the Ataris, and then we're Mexico City with Sum 41 at the end of the month in March. And then the list goes on. I won't name all the dates, but a couple sold out shows in Denver and Salt Lake City. And then we're doing that last No Effects show in October.
Wow.
And then we're not quite ready to announce, but we're planning some stuff for the summer as well.
Love it.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Dope.
Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, killing it, man.
Great talking to you.
Thanks for having
you.
Yes.
And I'll hit you up and see when I can pop over and check the place out. Yeah.
Yeah. Come hang. Let's go to Olala.
Reminisce in Olala.
Love that.
Awesome. Right. Thanks, dude.
Yep.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
So cool to catch up, and so many memories came back to me in the conversation that, you know, had gone dormant. So that's always really fun. And yeah, what a great dude. I can't, there's nothing but awesomeness to speak of my Carrera. So
the hardest person working in music today.
100%. Yeah,
he crushes it
for sure.
Well, for those that are wondering who Jeremy is, you may recognize his voice from the podcast Rumors Are True, which we have been on.
Yes,
that sounds
have.
Familiar.
He just happened to be in town, and it was like, well, we're going to record. You want to come on and be a part of this?
Yes, so. Yes. You do not turn down Matthew Schwartz and Aaron Sprinkle. Let's just say that up front. I'm just outcast.
So we're going to have him join us for the Patreon part of our podcast to talk about anything he wants. So we're going to do that here in a second. Before we do that, I want to thank our newest Patreon, George Gonzalez.
Thanks, George.
Thank you for joining, George. Also, thank you to everyone that is a Patreon subscriber. I get that word right. A Patreon subscriber. If you want to become a Patreon... God, I can't talk. If you want to become a Patreon subscriber, we are accepting people always. And you directly help make this happen. We have stickers, tees, discounts on merch. You get episodes early. You get exclusive content. You get exclusive content, including Jeremy in this
and
episode.
And it will help.
Woohoo.
We also do quarterly hangs.
Yeah, we're going to do quarterly hangs. And it helps pay for Matthew's 3 martini lunches, too.
Yeah, I had one beer.
I had one beer.
One beer at one job. If you want to find us, if you want to ask us questions, you want to talk to us, you can find us on the internet under Moon Traveling Podcast. You can find us on all social media. We're everywhere. Our website, Spotify.com/Moon Traveling Podcast. We also have an email, moontravelingpodcast@gmail.com. And I think that's it for now. I missed anything?
I think you got it.
Cool. Thank you guys for joining us. And check out our next episode with Matt Pruitt, the Sasquatch Hunter.
Ooh. That's cool.
It's dope.
For now, bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Peace.